Hello and welcome to Pardes from Jerusalem, the podcast series from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies in Jerusalem. I'm Larry Kluger, a Pardes alum. This week, Ki Tavo. Thank you very much to all of you who donated during Pardes' fundraiser last week. If you haven't yet donated, or if you didn't hear about it, there's still time to donate. Your donation will make a real difference at Pardes, and we very much appreciate it. You can donate anytime online via pardes.org.il. Look for the donation link in the upper right-hand corner. Thank you very much. This week, Ki Tavo with Rabbi Michael Hatton. Rabbi Michael Hatton is a member of the Pardes faculty. And now, Rabbi Michael Hatton.
Parshat Ki Tavo is a lengthy section that optimistically begins with the description of the ritual of the Bikurim, or the first fruits, that are to be presented by the grateful farmer at the temple in Jerusalem. In an evocative ceremony, the fruits are gently raised upon the shoulder and then put down next to the altar. As the farmer experientially relives the odyssey of exile and redemption, and then recites a formula that briefly outlines the history of the people of Israel. In charged phrases, he recalls their descent to Egypt and subsequent enslavement, their outcries to God who heard their woes and liberated them, and their eventual arrival and settlement in the land that he gave them as their eternal possession. The parsha then continues with another agricultural observance concerning the tithing of the crops. The separated tithes that had been stored up by the landowner in anticipation of an opportunity for their allocation must be allotted to their respective recipients, whether that is the landless Levi or else the indigent and the needy. And the landowner must then solemnly declare that he has not unlawfully withheld them from distribution. Once again, the declaration singles out the land for special mention, and then concludes with a poignant prayer that God sustain his people upon it and grant them its bounty. Look down from your holy habitation in the heavens and bless your people Israel as well as the land that you have given us, just as you swore to our ancestors concerning a land that flows with milk and honey. Devarim chapter 26, verse 15. The next sections of the Parsha, all unabashedly hopeful in tone, speak of Israel's inseparable bond with God, as well as of the heavy burden of responsibility that they must bear as a result. In essence, Moshe has now completed the review and the explication of the mitzvot of the Torah, and his concluding remarks therefore concern the people's formal acceptance of the Torah's commands in a covenantal ceremony. Moshe, the priests and the Levites, addressed all of Israel, stating, "Be attentive and listen, Israel, for on this day you have become a people to God your Lord. Hearken to the voice of God your Lord, perform his commands and decrees that I enjoin upon you this day." Devarim chapter 27, verses 9 and 10. What follows is a description of the National Assembly to be convened immediately after the people cross the River Jordan and enter the land. In the valley of Shechem, located between the summits of fertile Mount Gerizim and barren Mount Ebal, Israel is to construct a ceremonial altar. Upon the plaster that coats its uncut stones, the text of the Torah is to be clearly inscribed in order to impress upon the people that their success in the new land will be a direct result of their fidelity to God and to his teachings. Gathered as one, the people are then to listen attentively as the Levites loudly proclaim the list of the blessings and the curses. As each one of the maledictions is pronounced, they are to formally acknowledge their assent to its articles by solemnly responding, "Amen." the brief inventory of misdeeds and the main detailing concealed infractions concerning idolatry, breaches of trust, and sexual immorality is followed in turn by a concise passage spelling out the national blessings to be enjoyed if the people of Israel observe the Torah. International acclaim, bountiful crops, healthy offspring, victory over their foes, economic stability and expansion will be theirs. Chapter 27, verse 11 through chapter 28, verse 14. A much lengthier section describing the dire consequences that will befall the people of Israel should they fail to hearken to the Torah's words concludes the parsha. This tochacha, or admonition, climactically catalogues the converse of the earlier blessings. In progressively more frightful phrases, Israel's punishment should they fail to uphold the dictates of the Torah is spelled out. Sickness, drought, famine, and defeat will overtake them. The enemy will seize their crops, lay siege to their cities, and then cruelly exile them from their land. Israel will be violently scattered among the nations, there to serve lifeless gods of wood and stone in pathetic vulnerability. In interminable exile, they will remain until such a time as they initiate their restoration by considering their ways and remembering their God. The overall thrust of the parsha is thus a glaring study in contrasts: the good and the bad, the blessing and the curse, the promise of life and the threat of death, all of it pivoting precariously around the pledge of the new land. Israel's ineluctable destiny to be champions of God's teachings and exemplars of his righteous ways will in the end be realized, either consensually through the people's judicious exercise of their own free will and consent, or else coercively through the imposition of the corrective forces that they themselves will unleash as a consequence of their own ruinous choices. This week we will consider one single verse of the parsha, taken from the declaration of the first fruits described above. The medieval commentaries disagree concerning the meaning of the passage, and they in turn are in opposition to the traditional interpretation of the earlier rabbis. In the end, though, we will discover that the themes emphasized in the verse, according to all of the possible readings, highlight many of the larger ideas that animate the parsha as a whole. When you enter the land that God your Lord gives to you, and you shall possess it and dwell in it, then you shall take from the first fruits of the earth that you shall bring from the land that God your Lord gives you, and you shall place them in a basket. You shall go to the place that God will choose to cause his name to dwell there. You shall approach the Kohen who shall be there at that time and shall say to him, I declare this day before God your Lord that I have come into the land that God swore unto our ancestors to give us. The Kohen shall take the basket from your hands and place it down before the altar of God your Lord. You shall proclaim before God your Lord, Arami Oved Avi. He went down to Egypt and sojourned there few in number, and there became a great, powerful, and populous nation. The Egyptians dealt harshly with us and afflicted us and put upon us difficult labor. We cried out to God, the Lord of our ancestors, and God heard our voice, saw our affliction, our burden, and our distress. God took us out of Egypt with a strong hand, an outstretched arm, awesome acts, signs, and wonders. He brought us to this place and gave us this land, a land flowing with milk and honey. And now I have brought the first fruits of the earth that you have given me, God. You shall put them down before God your Lord and prostrate yourself before God your Lord. You shall rejoice in all the good that God your Lord has given to you and to your household, you and the Levite, and the convert that dwells in your midst. Devarim chapter 26, verses 1 through 11. The basic schema of the rite is straightforward enough, and we can conveniently categorize it into three discrete elements. Number one, the bringing of the first fruits and their presentation. Number two, the declaration. Number 3, the joyous aftermath. It should be noted that while the account of our passage is described from the perspective of the individual farmer who brings the fruits to God's house and subsequently rejoices with family and a close circle of associated individuals, the declaration is phrased in the plural. In it, the supplicant concisely recalls Jewish national history, placing particular emphasis on the experience of the enslavement in Egypt, the Exodus, and the entry into the land. The themes of the declaration once again pivot around contrasts. Few ancestors becoming a multitude, oppressed slaves achieving freedom, and homeless people acquiring a land flowing with milk and honey. It is the opening words of the declaration in verse 5, however, that are most cryptic. Arami oved avi, an Aramean who wandered, was my father, is seemingly a description of our ancestor, the very one who is immediately described as having gone down to Egypt and sojourned there, few in number. But who exactly is this unnamed ancestor that is described as an Aramean? Here, the Rashbam and Ibn Ezra, two contemporary rationalists of the 12th century, the one from northern France and the other from southern Spain, disagree. Rashbam explains, "My ancestor Avraham was an Aramean, a nomadic wanderer from the land of Aram, as the verse states, 'Go forth from your land and from your birthplace and from your father's house, to the land that I will show you.'" Bereishit chapter 12, verse 1. Further it states, "And so it was that when God caused me to wander forth from my father's house, ka'asher hit'u oti Elokim mibeit avi." Bereishit chapter 20, verse 13. The usage of oved and to'eh is the same. They both describe a person who is exiled. As the verse in Psalm states, "I have wandered as a lost sheep. Ta'iti kese oved. Seek out your servant." Chapter 119, verse 176. Or, as in, "Lost sheep are your people, for their shepherds have led them astray." Ovdot hite'um. Jeremiah chapter 50, verse 6. This is to say that our ancestors came from a foreign land to this land, and God gave it to us. For the Rashbam, the wandering Aramean of our passage is none other than our father Avraham. Hailing from a foreign land, from the northern reaches of the Euphrates, elsewhere known as Aram Naharaim, or Aram between the rivers, Avraham heard God's call and set forth for Canaan. The journey was long and arduous, and having arrived, Avraham and Sarah did not remain stationary, but like proverbial sheep, they nomadically wandered the length and breadth of the central hill country. And though buoyed by the recurring divine promises of offspring and land, those pledges remained throughout their lifetimes painfully beyond their reach. It would in fact be many centuries before their descendants began the lengthy process of possessing the land. Oved, then, means wandering and serves as a description of our ancestors' travails. The Rashbam's reading is therefore about glaring contrasts. At first we were nomless homads. At first we were nomless nomad. At first we were homeless nomads, exiled from our birthplace, but denied a place to call our own, forced to seek refuge under the protection of foreign kingdoms that oppressed us mightily. But then God heard our cries, liberated us from domination, and brought us into Canaan so that we might finally strike down roots and build a state, so that finally the weary farmer might gratefully declare that now I have brought the first fruits of the earth that you have given me, God. If we adopt the interpretation of the Rashbam, then we must assume that when the verse states that my father was a wandering Aramean, and then goes on to describe how he went down to Egypt and sojourned there few in number, and there he became a great, powerful, and populous nation, that the latter half of the verse is speaking figuratively. This is because, although Abraham himself did briefly go down to Egypt when famine struck Canaan after his arrival, Genesis chapter 12, verse 10, he did not remain there long, and he and Sarah had no offspring until many years after their return. It was only his descendants that went down to Egypt for an extended stay, and there they became numerous, powerful, and eventually the objects of Pharaoh's xenophobic zeal. Rabbi Avraham Ibn Ezra provides an alternative reading, identifying the Aramean of the passage with a different ancestor of the people of Israel, and providing us in the process with another aspect of what it means to be lost. It seems to me, he says, that the Aramean is our father Yaakov. It is as if the passage states that when my father was in Aram, he was lost. For to be lost in this context means to be indigent and without means. Similarly, the verse states, give strong drink to he who is lost and wine to those who are bitter in spirit, Oved. Proverbs chapter 31, verse 6. It then goes on to indicate that he will drink and forget his poverty, and his travail will he no longer remember. The verse therefore should be rendered as, a poor Aramean was my father. The meaning of the matter is that I did not inherit this land from my father because he was poverty-stricken when he first came to Aram. Also, he dwelt in Egypt few in number and only afterwards became a numerous nation. You, God, brought us forth from slavery and gave us a goodly land. For Ibn Ezra, then, the passage recalls the life of our father Yaakov, who was forced to flee his brother Esau's murderous wrath. Sorrowfully, Yaakov left behind his aged parents, heading northeastwards at his mother's behest in search of refuge in the home of his wily uncle Laban. Arriving at Aram, Yaakov was entirely without means, at first sustained by his mother's deceitful brother, but then indentured to him in tending the sheep. Though Yaakov acquired wives and flocks while in Laban's employ, true security and stability eluded him. In the end, Yaakov had to take flight from his uncle, who had brazenly changed the conditions of employment innumerable times, never failing to capitalize on Yaakov's vulnerability. Once again, our passage provides us with a study in contrasts, but this time it is not exile versus settlement, but rather poverty versus wealth that is highlighted. The presenter of the first fruits recalls the distress of Father Yaakov, whose poverty necessarily produced dependence, and whose dependence encouraged oppression at Laban's hands. Yaakov did in fact go down to Egypt after famine in Canaan forced the household to relocate, while Yosef's position of power and authority as the Pharaoh's vizier created ideal conditions for their absorption. There the family remained, but soon the welcome of their Egyptian hosts was exhausted. A new king arose over the two lands, and shortly thereafter, Yaakov's descendants were cruelly enslaved. Finally, God heard their cries and redeemed them, eventually bringing them to a land flowing with milk and honey. Industriously, they tilled its terrace slopes, and the land gave forth its bounty. Now standing before the altar, the appreciative farmer, his basket laden with a representative selection of his field's bounty, recalled the earlier days when poverty and indigence were his ancestors' lot. And then solemnly he thanked God and prostrated himself before taking his leave. Here then are two readings, one that emphasizes the precious gift of a place to call home, and the other that celebrates the good fortune of prosperity and economic triumph. Both Rashbam as well as Ibn Ezra buttress their respective interpretations with other scriptural references, but in the end, their explanations really need no additional support. They are so intuitively correct that proof is unnecessary. No man who is homeless or else poor can truly be independent. And the blessing of a land, then, cannot be fully realized as long as one lives under the domination, political or economic, of overlords. The Israelite farmer, then, had much for which to be grateful. Cognizant of his ancient history of expulsion and want, he thanked God in sincerity for having helped him to overcome the earlier challenges. As Moshe's life ebbs away, he is careful to not only impress upon Israel their bright future, but also to remind them of their difficult past, so they might never lose sight of God's blessings. The land of Canaan beckons. An end at last to their nomadic wanderings and extended state of dependence. But Israel's success upon its fertile soil will be an ongoing function of their ability to internalize the core ideas contained in the Declaration of the First Fruits. Arami Oved Avi. Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you, Rabbi Han. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you on the next episode of Pardes from Jerusalem.